Tensions rise in Venezuela today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump says all options are on the table for Venezuela, including military intervention. Venezuela's Nicolas Maduro has this reply.
Para, Donald Trump, para ahí.
The embattled socialist leader says Trump should stop pushing for actions that could lead to bloodshed. Meanwhile, Venezuela's opposition says all they want is for Maduro to step down and allow new elections.
We don't want any war in this country. We are peaceful people. We are a peaceful society.
The latest on the situation in Venezuela. And later, with Brexit looming, one Briton chooses to become a citizen of Germany.
I have to think about my future, my children's future.
Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Nicolas Maduro remains, in title anyway, the president of Venezuela on this Monday, but he's also embattled. And the dividing line isn't just between Maduro and opposition leader Juan Guaido. It's also between Maduro and the growing list of world leaders who've called for him to step down. President Trump has been vocal in his opposition to Maduro, saying this weekend that military options are on the table. Today, Maduro responded with sharp words.
Para. Para, Donald Trump. Para ahí. Estás cometiendo errores que te van a...
In an interview with a Spanish journalist, Maduro told Trump to stop and that Trump risks staining his own presidency with blood. As the rhetoric around war and intervention ratchets up outside of Venezuela, inside the country, opposition leaders are trying to keep up the pressure on Maduro. The opposition is in the majority in Venezuela's National Assembly, but they haven't been able to exercise much power. I asked Manuela Bolivar, an opposition lawmaker in Caracas, if she would welcome military intervention by the U.S. in Venezuela.
We are fighting not only with a dictatorship, we are fighting with organized crime. These people inside this regime has nexus with drug trafficking and all that stuff. For that reason, we are continually sending messages to army, to our army, Venezuelan army, to be in support of the Venezuelans. We are asking for elections, not war, but election.
Right.
But this regime is blocking in any kind of ways, you know. Is right now, this today, Nicolas Maduro says that we don't need any humanitarian aid because we don't have an humanitarian crisis. What? This man is really nuts.
If I can ask you one more time, would you accept, as a congressperson, would you accept military assistance from the United States?
I repeat, we're going to support any humanitarian aid that every country give us.
I'm not asking about humanitarian aid. I'm asking specifically about military aid for Venezuela. Would you support that? Would you accept that from the United States? Yes or no?
And I repeat, we are facing a complex situation. We are facing economical crisis. We are facing a humanitarian crisis. We are asking for elections. We are asking for respect for our constitution.
That was opposition lawmaker Manuela Bolivar. I also reached out to her colleague in the National Assembly, Armando Armas, and asked him if he'd welcome the arrival of U.S. troops in the region.
I think the people of Venezuela are so desperate that we'll welcome any kind of help that we could get, not just the U.S., but from our neighbors, from the European Union, from Canada. If our adversaries, they do have military assistance from Russia and from Cuba and from China, I think we should need, of course, a little bit of help from our allies, European Union, our neighbors.
Armando Armas, there are so many of Venezuela's generals and military leaders who support Nicolas Maduro. Why is that?
Because they are corrupt. They're partners in crime. He's given them contracts and positions of power in many public companies. And, you know, the extraction of gold and diamonds and coltan in the southern part of our country. That's huge, man. And it's terrible what is happening here.
If Maduro was overthrown tomorrow by the military, would you be happy?
I will be happy if we have a transitional government and then a call for free and fair elections as soon as possible.
How much are you worried about the future just generally and the possibility of civil war in your country?
I'm very worried. I am very worried. These are the guys who we are dealing with. They are thugs. It's a criminal state. It's not even a failed state. Imagine that Pablo Escobar in Colombia would have taken over the control of the government in the 80s in Colombia. That's what is happening here. So, of course, I'm worried about a conflict. And, of course, I'm worried about the measures that we have to take afterwards. But we got to do what we got to do.
That was Venezuelan opposition lawmaker Armando Armas. Earlier, we heard from his colleague Manuela Bolivar. Meanwhile, today, several Western European leaders all signaled their support for Venezuela's opposition leader, Juan Guaido. But a few countries are backing Maduro, or at least arguing that Venezuelans should be left alone to determine their course. Among Maduro's supporters, Russia's Vladimir Putin. The connection between Caracas and Moscow is a complex one, and to understand it, we turn to journalist Anatoly Kormenayev. He reported for years out of Venezuela and then went to Russia, and now he's back in Caracas for the New York Times. He says to understand the two countries, it's good to start with Venezuela's previous leader, Hugo Chavez.
Vladimir Putin came to power basically the same year as Hugo Chavez, the Venezuelan leader who's kind of responsible for the state the country is in now. And the two countries have had quite similar trajectories. They both benefited massively from the rise in oil prices in the 2000s. They both have gradually moved away from the West and adapted an increasingly adversarial position towards America. So Russian investments in Venezuela, on one hand, you have Russian government investment, and that's basically defense. Credits that the Russian government has given to Venezuela so they could buy air defense systems, their tanks, etc. And on the other hand, you have the oil investment. So this is the money that Russia state oil company Rosneft has given to Venezuela.
Right. The name Igor Sechin keeps popping up when you look at Russia's connections to Venezuela. Sechin's the head of Rosneft. That's Russia's national oil company. What kind of influence does he have?
Sechin is probably Russia's second most powerful man, and he's a sort of gray cardinal behind Putin, who has played an important part in projecting Russia's sort of influence abroad. Sechin pretty much single-handedly masterminded Rosneft's entry into Venezuela, and he basically ran his own foreign policy department, so to speak. So in parallel to what Russia's foreign ministry, what Russia's finance ministry were doing, Sechin had his own game in Venezuela, and he was basically selling himself to Putin as someone who can get things sorted anywhere in the world. He is probably the main reason, I would say, the single biggest factor for Russia's really strong support for Maduro in the middle of this crisis.
So when it comes to Venezuela, is Sechin a character that we should be paying more attention to perhaps than even Putin?
Absolutely. Sechin has staked a lot of his political capital on his success in Venezuela. If Maduro goes, Sechin's position becomes very, very weak. They're putting all their eggs in Maduro's basket.
So how much does Maduro really count on Russian support? Like, is there a scenario in which Vladimir Putin changes his mind about supporting Maduro?
I think Maduro is massively counting on Putin's support. You know, he doesn't really have many friends left. China, Turkey, Syria, these are just a few countries that have openly came out for Maduro. And in the case of China, it's pretty ambivalent support. The Chinese have accepted that Maduro may go anytime, that they will have to work with a new opposition. I wouldn't say the love is reciprocated on the Russian side. On one hand, publicly, Russian government has voiced very strong support for Maduro. But more behind the scenes, what we're seeing is even Russian state companies gradually cutting their exposure to Venezuela for fear of losing access to U.S. market because of sanctions. You know, Russia today is not Russia of 2000s. It's economically weaker. It doesn't have much spare resources to just continue propping up a losing government.
Anatoly Kormenayev in Caracas with the New York Times making the Russia-Venezuela connection for us. Thanks very much, Anatoly.
Thanks, Marco.
Last week, we told you about the upcoming presidential election in El Salvador. Well, last night, big parties across the country. Supporters of Nayib Bukele celebrating his victory. It is a big defeat for the country's long dominant parties on the right and left. Bukele was the mayor of the capital, San Salvador, but he's seen as an outsider who promised to fight corruption. It's not enough, though, to keep Salvadorans from wanting to leave and come to the U.S. More than a million Salvadorans are living here already, and the ones continuing to migrate are coming here not just by caravan, they're also coming by plane. Reporter Emily Green spent time with one woman in the hours before her big move.
It's the night before Dora Crespin is moving to the U.S., and she's stressed. Two big suitcases sit on the bed. They're filled with clothes, but also food. Lots of it. Chips, chocolate, cheese, varieties of which can't be found in the U.S. So many special requests from friends and relatives.
Chicharrones, elotitos, quesitos, mani japonés, cerecitas.
Dora's 9-year-old son, Marco, sits on the bed as she flings items into the bags with a fan blowing in the background. It's hot here. Marco isn't going with his mom. He's staying here in El Salvador, and he says he's going to miss her. What do you like to do with your mom?
Going to the movies, sleeping with her. Sometimes I sleep with her, not in my room.
Does it make you feel comforted?
Yeah.
Marco has lived alone with his mom for the past 3 years, while his dad was in the U.S. Now, mom and dad are trading places. It's Dora's turn to live in the U.S. and apply for citizenship. She already has U.S. residency. She says she's leaving with Marco's future in mind.
We're planning with my ex-husband that he can go to the university in the States because it's a better education, you know. He can be whatever he wants. So if I have the citizenship, I'm going to be free to go over there or live over there or work over there.
But Dora confesses the move is also to pursue her dreams. She wants to study to become a sexual psychologist. To be clear, Dora is not fleeing danger or poverty, but she says she's still part of the exodus of Salvadorans leaving because they feel stuck.
Over there you go because you need the money, not because you have your family and you're going to be happy. Not at all. Here you are happy. You have your comfort food. You have your family, your relatives. But over there in the States, it's like solitude. You're lonely. Really, really lonely.
As we talk, the small house begins filling up with relatives. Dora puts the final touches on a goodbye dinner. On top of everything she has to do, Dora is thinking about the next day's presidential elections. She's excited to vote for Nayib Bukele. She worked for him when he was mayor of San Salvador.
If he says that something is going to be done, it's done. He doesn't accept a no for an answer. So everything he has to change in the country, he's going to make it, no matter what.
But the prospect of Bukele being president is still not enough to make Dora stay. The next morning, I return to Dora's house. She's even more frantic than the night before. The suitcases are overweight. All the food is weighing them down. Marco, meanwhile, is still in his pajamas, playing a video game. He's being standoffish, unhelpful.
Papá te la puede comprar aquí. Marco, por favor. Marco, por favor.
Finally, all the suitcases are weighed and in the car. She hugs her parents.
Gracias por todo.
It's a short goodbye. Dora wipes away a few tears. She and her son Marco climb in the car on the way to the airport. But there's one thing she has to do before she leaves for the U.S. Vote.
So I'm folding it in four, and that's it.
At the polling station, Dora drops her ballot into a wooden box. An hour later, at the airport, Marco cuddles up to his mom in a Pizza Hut restaurant booth. Dora doesn't want to make too big a deal of leaving. She says it will upset her son more. Later that night, Dora's candidate, Nayib Bukele, wins the presidential elections. Dora watches the results from her new home, the United States. For The World, Emily Green, San Salvador.
Life during migration. If you want to know more about El Salvador's new president, Nayib Bukele, go to theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. 15 years ago today, Mark Zuckerberg launched what he called the Facebook.com.
When we first launched, we were hoping for, you know, maybe 400, 500 people. And now we're at 100,000 people. So who knows where we're going next?
2 billion people now use Facebook. That's billion with a B. And the site has changed the way we do pretty much everything. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou and Brandy Fullwood are going to take you through the past 15 years.
So do you remember when you first got Facebook, Brandy? I do remember when I first got Facebook. I was about in 6th or 7th grade, so 2006, 2007, when Facebook first came out. And you had to at least be a high school student or a college student to get onto Facebook at the time. So we just had people's older siblings kind of tag us on to it.
Yeah, same. I think I was late middle school, early high school. And I actually remember at the time I had just moved to the U.S. from Greece, and I wanted my friends to also have access to it.
So you started it.
I am convinced, actually, that I was the person who brought Facebook to Greece.
Yeah, because this is before Mark Zuckerberg actually expands Facebook internationally.
2008, a lot of what we've done is made it so that we can grow internationally. So,
and by then they have about, I don't know, like 100 million users. Mm-hmm. And one of those users is this guy who's in Nairobi right now, Mzwakithi Shongwe. And when we started reporting, I reached out to a lot of international students that I knew from college and just asked them what Facebook was like when they first got on it.
You would have entire conversations by pasting on the other person's wall. It was so bad. I mean, they should have been Facebook consultants just telling us, like, don't do it.
And recently he had a couple memories pop up, you know, just getting Facebook memories. And he found this public wall-to-wall flirting sesh he was having with someone like in middle school or early high school. So
embarrassing. Yeah, Facebook. I don't want to see the things I was posting when I was in late middle school, early high school.
I kind of want to see those things. If I look right now, will I be able to find some of the stuff you were posting?
I think we should move on.
We'll come back to it.
Yeah. No. but seriously, it is really fascinating to think about all these features that Facebook was rolling out at the time that we were all using to interact with one another. Like, you know, the news feed was an early one and you could just endlessly scroll through it. Then there was the...
like life events and the like
events.
Button.
The like button. That was... so can you imagine like what life would be like without a like button? And something that was interesting for me to see was how people were using certain features differently depending on where they lived. And that's something actually that one of our listeners, Rebecca Hyams, told us about. She's German, but she now lives in Canada.
Particularly in Germany, people are so much more careful and / paranoid about what they share, not have a profile picture, not have their real name. Whereas I find that in Canada, and I believe in the US as well, people are much more like out there and like, that's the cute thing my baby's doing today.
Today, Facebook hits 1 billion users.
Yes, that's billion with a B.
That means one out of every 7 people on planet Earth actively uses Facebook.
So it's 2012 and Facebook hits 1 billion users. And they start to have to figure out what that means to have 1 billion users on the site. Like, it's not this little website where you like a bunch of pages or you're flirting with people or you're even poking them or doing all the scandalous things that Lydia was doing in middle school. It's so much more serious than that.
Facebook had a problem with hate speech in Myanmar from almost the very, very beginning.
That's David Madden, an Australian entrepreneur who a few years ago started a community tech hub in Myanmar.
One thing that's really important to understand is that in a place like Myanmar, Facebook really is the internet.
And David Madden told me that in 2014, things started to get really, really bad on Facebook in Myanmar.
When a sort of extremist nationalist monk shared on his Facebook page an alleged rape of a Buddhist woman. And this Facebook post sparked riots that left 2 people dead. And suddenly it became clear what the consequences of misuse of the Facebook platform could be in Myanmar.
And those consequences were huge, Brandy, as you and I both know, because by last year, 2018, you had the UN, the United Nations, accusing Facebook of playing a role in the violence we saw against Rohingya Muslims.
Senator, what's happening in Myanmar is a terrible tragedy.
And that same thing came up with Facebook last year when they were asked to testify in front of Congress.
UN investigators have blamed you blame Facebook.
And this wasn't just going on in Myanmar, but also in Vietnam, in India, in so many places around the world. I interviewed Sanjana Hatatua, who's from Colombo, Sri Lanka, where they've had a lot of issues with fake news and hate speech.
The flip side of that is that Facebook has also, in my country, in the Philippines, in South America, and in a number of other examples around the world, been integral to the kind of content production and discussion that actually has strengthened democracy, strengthened dissent. And that's not a story that's actually well covered. And in a sense, I understand why. But may I just end by saying that that is the story. Facebook is part of our DNA. It's historically unprecedented that one company and its set of tools, apps, and services is so inextricably entwined in our commerce, in our socio-political life, in our day-to-day activities, in our day-to-day conversations. So, you know, it's a very, very complex, evolving, fluid dynamic that Facebook finds itself in.
Facebook Chief Operating Officer Sheryl Sandberg made the rounds on Capitol Hill last week amid the growing furor over Moscow's use of social media to influence the 2016 presidential election.
New developments tonight on Cambridge Analytica, the firm that worked for the Trump campaign and tried to influence American voters using information harvested from 50 million Facebook users.
It's clear now that we didn't do enough to prevent these tools from being used for harm. And that goes for fake news, for foreign interference in elections and hate speech, as well as developers and data privacy. We didn't take a broad enough view of our responsibility, and that was a big mistake. And it was my mistake, and I'm sorry.
And I know today that so many people want to leave Facebook, but it's such a big part of everyday life now.
Yeah, I also feel like torn. It doesn't really feel like the place that we got on, you know, 15, however many years ago. It feels kind of tainted.
Yeah.
Is it time to bring Marco back in?
Marco!
Polo!
Hey!
Hey, Marco. So you quit Facebook, right? Why?
Yeah, over a year ago. I was finding myself coming into the office and turning on Facebook almost before I was even paying attention to the news. So it took too much time out of my life. Where do you think Facebook is going, though?
We know that user growth has been steady here in the U.S. Surprisingly, given all the scandals they've had the past couple of years, they're growing in Europe and other parts of the world. But I think the bigger issue that Facebook's going to have to deal with is that they have a teen problem.
Yeah, Facebook's not cool anymore.
No, they're not cool. If you ask my 17-year-old sister, she'll tell you it's for old people.
Yeah, that's what my 17-year-old daughter says. She doesn't even barely knows what Facebook is, right? Anyway, we're going to do this in another 15 years to see where we're at with Facebook in 30.
We'll make a Facebook event about it.
2034. Can't wait. The world's Brandy Fullwood and the world's Lydia Emanuele-Du. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Thanks, Marco.
We asked you if you want to quit Facebook but can't. Check out the many reasons why at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. A well-known Atlanta rapper is now facing possible deportation to Britain, where he was born.
Even if he does get deported and end up back in the UK, I'm sure he's going to have a lot to say for himself and a lot to say about the situation, because he's an outspoken rapper who really does like try and talk about social justice and the things that are affecting people's lives.
The case of 21 Savage, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. While millions of people were watching the Super Bowl in Atlanta last night, another news story was breaking in that city. Grammy-nominated rapper 21 Savage was arrested by ICE agents in Atlanta for allegedly overstaying his visa. According to ICE, 21 Savage was actually born in the UK and came to the US when he was a teenager. This all came as a surprise to millions of his fans across the globe. 21 Savage is known as an Atlanta rapper, and until now, his connection to the UK was pretty much unknown to the public. My BBC colleague Cameron Virk, who's in Atlanta, has been following the story closely. I asked him how people are reacting to this arrest.
Oh, it's incredibly confusing. Like, nobody saw it coming. He's someone who's just so closely tied to Atlanta and the music scene here. It was just a story you had to read a few times before you kind of get your head around it.
According to ICE spokesman Brian Cox, 21 Savage was convicted of felony drug charges in 2014. So is that charge in part why he's now facing deportation?
It looks like it, but that was in 2014, right? So they've known about this for a while. So it's a bit unclear as to how that's related to what's going on currently. People are a bit confused by the timing of it all.
So give us the basic story here. 21 Savage moved to the United States when, and what's been his life in Atlanta since he got here?
According to ICE, he came to the U.S. when he was 12. He had a visa for 1 year. They say that he's overstayed his visa by 13 years. They say that he came over from the U.K. But even if he was born in the UK, he moved to Atlanta when he was 12. And that's a formative time in your life.
How has 21 Savage kind of portrayed his upbringing in Atlanta?
He's told a lot of stories about a violent upbringing. He talks about his brother being shot and killed. And he's really well known for this knife tattoo in the middle of his forehead, which he said he only got because his brother got one. And then when his brother died, he got the tattoo. It's a tale that's probably quite familiar in rap. But again, he's kind of overcome that image in some ways and tried to show people some other ways of living your life.
And for those who have never heard of 21 Savage, I mean, where does he rank in the hip-hop world? How big is he?
Oh, he's huge now. There aren't many bigger names at this moment in time than 21 Savage. He started crossing over into the mainstream a lot last year when he did a track with Post Malone called Rockstar, which I'm sure lots of people would have heard. It was a chart topper in the US, in the UK, across Europe. I used to chop hard, living like a rock star. I'm living like a rock star. I've been popping, man, I feel just like a rock star. He kind of made his name rapping about the violence he saw around him in Atlanta. So one of his first songs was called Red Ops, and it talks about people who he grew up around who weren't necessarily his friends and that kind of stuff. Since then, his most recent album is called I Am Is Greater Than I Was, which kind of gives you a feel, you know, for the type of content that he's been putting out. How many times did she leave? A lot. How many times did she cry? A lot. How many chances she done gave you? Around with these thighs. Every day that I'm alive, I'm a ride with this stick. I'd rather be. And in that, he talks about not being able to imagine the pain of a parent who's separated from their child at the border, as we've seen happen over the last few months in America.
How have 21 Savage's fans reacted to this news? Because he is very much an Atlanta rapper, as you say. And for people to know, that means something. And now that that part of the story turns out not to be true, even though he did grow up there, he's not from Atlanta. So how are his fans feeling?
They kind of all had a similar feeling that even though he may have not been born in Atlanta, having been here since he was 12 and being really well known in the communities that he's from and the kind of work he does, they still see him as a credible Atlanta rapper.
It makes me wonder how valuable an American narrative is to, like, the legitimacy or the authenticity of a rap artist today.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I thought this because maybe 10 years ago, UK rap wasn't really in the position that it's in now. Like, now it's quite a credible genre, like, but it still seems like, especially on social media, a lot of people have been joking about what 21 Savage's lyrics would mean if he was living in England and was from England. They take on quite a different meaning. Because obviously English culture is very different to American culture.
So, Cameron, where do you think the story goes from here? Because 21 Savage is, as you said, he's at the height of his career, just came out with a new album that got critical acclaim. He's nominated for a Grammy. Will he be deported? And is his career over, whether he's deported or not?
I don't think his career will be over from this. He's reached a point where he can't disappear now. If anything, it could end up helping him. We're here talking about 21 Savage to probably plenty of people that have never heard of him before. Even if he does get deported and end up back in the UK, there's a ton of talent who'll be looking to work with him. I'm sure he's going to have a lot to say for himself and a lot to say about the situation because he's an outspoken rapper who really does like try and talk about social justice and the things that are affecting people's lives.
My BBC colleague Cameron Virk in Atlanta, thanks very much.
Thanks for speaking to me, guys.
An update now on a story we've been following. Remember we told you about the Dutch church that's been holding a nonstop prayer service for the past 3 months, all to protect a family from deportation? Well,
after 96 days and 2,306 hours of continuous worship, the Bethel Church service has ended.
The service has ended. That's Theo Hetema, the head of the Protestant Church in The Hague. There's a law in the Netherlands that dates back to the Middle Ages that says authorities cannot go into a church while it's in service. So when the Tamrazian family was about to be deported back to Armenia, they fled to the Bethel Church. The church took them in and held a continuous prayer service so that authorities couldn't detain and deport them. Last week, the government announced that the Tamrazian's case would be reconsidered, along with the cases of hundreds of other families. Theo Hetema said he was with the Tamrazians the night the announcement was made.
We couldn't believe it. Nobody of us could believe it. We heard it and we thought, oh, can this be true? So it was late in the evening, and the first thing in the next morning was to phone with the ministry, to phone with parliament members. Can this really be true? Can this be true for this family? And at 10 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday, we heard, yes, it will apply to this family, to the Tambrasian family.
I saw a photo of a flyer or a poster on the front of the church just in the last couple of days. What does it say?
Yeah, during the 3 months, we had a post on the door. Please ring the door because of special circumstances, we cannot open the door for you. And now we have a post on the door. The church is finally closed. Yeah, we were very glad about that. It's very strange for us because we want to be an open church to everybody. And of course, everybody's welcome.
Yeah.
But for this very moment, we are glad that we could say to anybody, the church is closed for now.
Yeah, closed in a good way.
Yeah, that was strange and grateful.
But it's not all good news. Yes, the Dutch government agreed to let hundreds of families stay in the country, but it also ended a policy known as the children's pardon, which is kind of like DACA, where refugees who were brought to the Netherlands as kids can be given a residence permit if their applications get bogged down for too long in court. For Hetema, it was a regrettable compromise.
Yeah. It's not ideal, but it's I think in the present political circumstances in the Netherlands, it's the best solution, and it gives a fair chance to some hundreds of families.
I mean, you say the political situation right now, and we hear so much about the rise of populist nationalism across Europe. The story in the church in The Hague suggests the opposite is also very much alive. What does this tell us about attitudes in Europe right now, or maybe just in the Netherlands? Is what you did with this vigil, is it a trend or simply a momentary antidote to the nationalism?
No, there have been polls in the Netherlands, and some 50% is in favor of a children's pardon, but 50% is against it. So it's half-half.
You did make a really noble effort. I mean, with this 24/7 vigils, 90 some odd days, as you said, 2,300 hours. Do you have a final understanding of how many different people held sermons and how many different countries were represented by these efforts to keep the church open?
I think that's the miracle of Bethel, that we started with a small group. And when I started at October 26, there were only 3 people after me to fill 1 hour of the service. And we just started to phone and call our colleagues, and it grew. And so Protestant ministers from the Netherlands came, Catholic priests, laymen, and then it started to come from abroad. So from Belgium, Germany, England, from the States, France, Switzerland, from all around Europe and the States, people came. Finally, we had nearly 1,000 pastors. 12,000 people have been in our church hall. It's incredible. And I couldn't have believed that this would become true at the end of October. No, it's, it's incredible.
It is pretty amazing. Reverend Theo Hetema is the chair of the Protestant Church of The Hague. Good to speak with you again. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Goodbye.
The Tamrazians are still living in the Bethel Church for the time being. Their application for asylum is being reviewed. Now, photos and videos of just about everything in our lives are so ubiquitous, it's hard to imagine anyone saying that a major moment in world events did not need to be recorded. But in the months following the end of World War II, as Nazi war criminals were put on trial in Nuremberg, it was not a huge priority to capture the proceedings on film. Reporter Chris Harlan Dunaway looked into what was recorded, images and sound, and why much of it was locked away for decades.
Less than 50 hours of the Nuremberg trials were filmed. Film was expensive, and many thought it wouldn't be important. But the court made written transcripts and 1,942 black gramophone audio records. When the trials ended, those recordings were shipped to the International Court of Justice in The Hague.
They were, in a way, forgotten. Not lost, but forgotten.
That's Dr. Ottar Johnson. He's a retired engineer from the University of Fribourg in Switzerland. In 2006, the International Court of Justice rediscovered the records and wanted to digitize them. One major problem: a record needle might damage or destroy them. But Johnson's lab had been working on a solution.
A completely strange idea about taking a picture of a record, look at sound, and extract the sound.
Johnson took a photograph of a record in a dark room, then scanned the film negative onto a computer, where an algorithm read the record's surface. Archivists with the International Court of Justice brought 10 Nuremberg records to Johnson to test the technology. They gathered around to listen.
We charge that all of the atrocities against Jews were the manifestation and culmination of the Nazi plan to which every defendant in this box was a party.
It was very, very clear. It was a recording of Jackson.
He's referring to Robert Jackson, chief prosecutor for the United States at Nuremberg.
We must never forget that the record on which we judge these defendants today is the record on which history will judge us tomorrow.
When you have the sound, you feel you're in the middle of it. While when you have just the transcript, you're outside it.
And here's Hermann Göring, once the second most powerful man in Nazi Germany, and arguably the most wanted Nazi still alive after the war. Jackson cross-examines Göring in the marquee matchup of the entire trial. Göring gives long answers, and Jackson loses patience.
But this witness, it seems to me, is adopting and has adopted in the dock and in the stand an arrogant and contemptuous attitude toward this tribunal, which is giving him the trial that he never gave another living soul, or dead ones either.
When the trial ended, Göring was sentenced to hang. He cheated the noose by killing himself with a cyanide capsule in his cell. Besides those on trial, the newly unearthed recordings include many victims of the Holocaust. Even though it's in another language, the emotion really comes across when you hear the actual audio. This is Abram Sutzgever, a Jewish poet trapped in a ghetto in Vilnius, Lithuania. By the end of the Nazi extermination there, the Jewish population fell from roughly 100,000 to a few hundred who managed to survive. In his testimony, Sutzgever says one day a pile of shoes arrived in Vilnius. Among the heap, he says he spotted his mother's. Sutzgever pauses, unable to continue with his testimony. Ottar Johnson's discovery unearthed these recordings. But ironically, his technology was never used. When archivists were testing the records at Johnson's lab, they discovered that they were in better shape than they originally thought. So they were able to digitize those with a straight record needle. Johnson says he doesn't care how the audio gets recaptured, just that we can hear it again.
We shouldn't forget, because if we forget, then there are risks of letting other people do similar things.
And archivists around the world are excited about Johnson's technology. The Library of Congress is looking into it. It's also being used at the Swiss Phonographic Archives to unlock audio from happier times, like post-war radio comedies and old classical music recordings. For The World, I'm Chris Harlan Dunaway.
And a special thanks to the International Court of Justice for letting us let you hear those Nuremberg recordings. Britain is polarized over Brexit, and a lot of Britons are making their feelings known through protests. Here's how musician Simon Walfish does it. That's Walfish singing Beethoven's Ode to Joy outside the British Parliament in London. He's also on cello as part of the group you heard. Ode to Joy also happens to be the anthem of the European Union. Walfish does this once a month. Otherwise, he's busy performing at concerts across Europe. As a British citizen, he's worried that his freedom to travel around the continent could be limited by Brexit. That's why he applied for German citizenship in 2016, right after the Brexit referendum. It turns out well over 3,000 other British Jews did the same thing. Walfish is the grandson of an Auschwitz survivor, and under German law, he's entitled to a passport. For him, the decision to seek German citizenship is personal.
It's a good tagline to say Jews are trying to jump ship, and actually, in a way, it plays into the hands of anti-Semites, if it's depending on how it's bracketed, because we... Unfortunately, I'm digging up paperwork of of the most horrendous tragedy. My great-grandparents were shot into a mass grave in the middle of Poland somewhere. You know, it's not like I'm doing this with a light heart, but I have to think about my future, my children's future, that our country is really suffering. You know, Great Britain is in serious trouble. Brexit, leaving the EU, is the wrong medicine for the illness that we're suffering.
Will you retain your British citizenship?
Yes, it is now possible. I think 10 years ago it wasn't, but you can actually keep both anyway. But in this law, Article 116, of course, it would be pretty bitter if they force you to give up your country of, you know, your adopted country.
Are you getting any pushback from Brits who are saying, why are you doing this?
Well, you know, in this extremely, what do you call it, echo chamber world we live in, I don't even know anyone who voted leave. So right. Everyone is saying, good on you, well done. My mum was born in Belgium. I hope that I can get, you know, everyone is trying to find a way to save themselves. It's not quite true. I do know some people have voted leave. I do a monthly musical protest outside Parliament where we sing Beethoven's Ode to Joy, which is, of course, the European anthem. And I've done about 21 of these so far since 2 years ago. People just thought, oh, here's a few crazy people singing Beethoven, that's nice, and would always clap and wave at us. And the idea was to put a bit of positivity and good feeling into the air around Westminster, which, as you can imagine, is pretty sour at the moment. But I had a chat with some flag-waving Leave voters who accused me of being unpatriotic. And I said, well, what could be more patriotic than going to another country as a performer and demonstrating excellence in a field, and then people can say, oh, wow, Brits are really good.
Have you gotten a response from Parliament? I mean, you're right outside Parliament.
We go specifically on a weekday around lunchtime when we know people are going to be shuffling between buildings, between meetings. Windows are going to, you know, maybe sometimes windows are going to be open. We know people can hear us. And sometimes we also sing the national anthem, God Save the Queen, just to annoy the Brexiters. And I've been in touch with a couple of MPs who have said, oh, yeah, I've heard you sing, and it's a big morale boost. But we're also singing for the civil servants. I'm sure if you speak to anybody in their official capacity, they would be ultra-democratic. But I'm a free person, and I can say that in my private conversations with many civil servants, they're absolutely horrified at what is being done to our country. It's a catastrophe.
And back to your backup plan for this catastrophe, as you call it. I mean, getting German citizenship, isn't that complicated for you? I mean, millions of Jews killed in the war. Your own grandmother said she would never go back to Germany.
She's changed her tack since the mid-90s. My grandmother's in Germany a lot now, speaking at schools. Last year, she spoke at the German parliament. She is extremely busy and dedicated. I was with her at the Jewish Museum in Berlin, where we did an event there, and then she was schlepped off in a car for 4 hours. She's 94. She can hardly walk. Mm. She needs a cigarette break every 20 minutes. and she does these talks. She talks to children. She talks to teachers. And I said to her, Grandma, you know, you don't need to do this. You can just sit at home and just relax. And she said, no. The last words her father said to her were, I count on you, Anita. Wow. Ich zähle auf dich, Anita. And she's doing this for her parents. I know that. And of course, 45 years after the liberation, she wouldn't speak German. She refused to ever set foot on German soil. But then when she came with the English Chamber Orchestra, which was her orchestra, she came with them to Germany once because she saw that one of their concerts was in Celle, which is a small town near Belsen. And she thought, well, I'm going to come along and have a look. And then the first German she spoke to offered to drive her to show her the camp. And she said, how old are you? And turns out he was born in 1946. Mm. And then she realized, well, okay, I can, if I sit at home and hate Germans just because they're German, that makes me just as bad as the Nazis then who hated Jews just because they were Jews. You can have individual judgments about individual people based on their characters, but we shouldn't be judging people as groups, especially not as national groups. And by becoming or taking on German citizenship, I feel very strongly that I'm actually doing something to honor my ancestors rather than to disgrace them.
Simon Walfish is a British musician with German citizenship since last year. He's a classical cellist and vocalist, and from time to time, he also protests Brexit outside of the British Parliament. Simon, thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks for talking to me.
Simon Walfish, vocalist and cellist, as I said, man of many talents. We leave you now with another cellist who also crosses borders, a Frenchman who has collaborated extensively with a virtuoso of the West African kora. This is Balaké Sissoko from Mali on the kora on the BBC Music Show Later with Jules Holland, and the cellist in question, Vincent Segal. Beautiful stuff on cello and kora from Vincent Segal and Balaké Sissoko. That is our show today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.